Greetings, folks, and welcome to episode 22 of the Far Beyond Metal podcast. I'm your host and spirit guide on this metal journey, Daniel Cordova. In this episode, I interview one of the most important people in metal, whom you may not even know about, Brian Slagle. Later, Vicky from The Agonist discusses her first band, and I recommend the band Drug Honky. First, a little bit of business. First, a little business up top. I have the recommendation segment that I end every episode with, and I've been getting bands emailing me a handful at a time wanting to be featured on the show, and I think it's great, and I want to hear a lot more bands. So I'm going to try and do this at the top this time, maybe get a little higher number of bands hitting me up. So if you want to be on the show, potentially be featured, have a song play, all that good stuff, hit me up at farbeyondmetaldan@gmail.com. You can send me Bandcamp, SoundCloud, Facebook links, all that good stuff. Once again, that's farbeyondmetaldan@gmail.com, and I'll reach out if I feel like it's a good fit. All right. Like I said a little bit ago, Brian Slagle is one of the most important people in heavy metal. In 1982, he released the Metal Massacre compilation, which helped to bring several bands to the masses. One of those bands was Metallica. The compilation was the first piece of what would become the Metal Blade record empire. As time went on, the label grew from a one-man operation into a full-fledged label, and they have signed and released records from Cannibal Corpse, Between the Buried and Me, Voivod, Behemoth, The Ocean, Merciful Fate, Slayer, and many, many more. After being harassed to write a book for some time now, Brian has finally done that with For the Sake of Heaviness, The History of Metal Blade Records. And he did it just in time to commemorate the 35th anniversary of the label. Brian and I discuss the book to an extent, but our interview is more about the man and his process. So before we dive in, here's some of one of the earliest Metal Blade releases from 1983's Show No Mercy, This is the Antichrist by Slayer. How you doing, man?
Good, how are you?
Not too bad. First question, does my voice sound crazy right now?
No, it sounds fine.
Okay, I did some tests and it made it seem like I had just like an octave shifter way down on my voice, so I sounded like Barry White, and I'm just hoping it's gone. I don't sound like Barry White, but if I do and it sounds fine,
no,
great.
No, you definitely don't.
Damn, well, next time maybe.
Sounds all good.
All right, so we'll go ahead and just jump right in, since I think you got a busy schedule ahead of you of a bunch of these.
Yep.
So your book, For the Sake of Heaviness, The History of Metal Blade Records, is being released at the end of August. This is your first book, correct?
Yes, sir.
What was the experience like writing your first book with Mark Eglinton, I believe it's pronounced?
Yeah. Surprisingly easy. I mean, well, I shouldn't say easy, but, you know, it's a bit of a daunting task when you start doing it. It's probably one of the reasons why I avoided doing something for a long time. It's like, it takes a lot of time, but it wasn't too bad. It was actually kind of a lot of fun because you got to kind of go back and kind of relive a lot of old stories and stuff that I hadn't really thought about in a long time. So it was a lot of time, but in the most part, it was actually pretty fun.
And this is the 35th anniversary of Metal Blade Records. What made you decide to do it at 35?
Well, you know, people have been bugging me to write a book for a long time. I'm like, no, you know, it's kind of when you get really old or something. And we, you know, kind of got to the point where, you know, every 5 years we try to do something to, you know, whatever the anniversary is. We've done box sets and tours and all these different things. So kind of thinking about what to do to document this, and it kind of just made sense to do a book at this point. It's been long enough. There's a lot of stuff out there. Might as well do it now. We can still remember it. So we did it.
And what are you hoping people take away from the book upon reading it?
You know, I don't know. It's a good question. It's kind of funny you do these things. I mean, I hopefully just people enjoy the story, and, you know, there's some interesting things in there if they're fans of, you know, the label or the artist. You know, you get a little bit of behind the scenes sort of stuff just to how it happened. And, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe if somebody wants to get involved in the music business, it gives them kind of a start to say, like, oh, I can do that too. You know, who knows?
And 35 years in, the music scene's, I'm sure, completely different. Are you expecting them to try and do this, read this and see it as a how-to, or is just sort of a, this is how I did it now. Good luck.
Well, I don't know if it's a real how-to necessarily, but certainly, you know, you can kind of see, you know, how everything kind of has come around. And really just the whole, I think the most interesting thing for me is just how, you know, metal has evolved so far from when we first, all of us started out, is just kids being, loving the music and just wanting to do anything we could to help it out, just how massive it's really become over all these years.
And it all started with the Metal Massacre compilation. I'm sure this is covered in the book, but how did that first one come to be?
Well, basically, I was just, I was working at a record store in LA. I was doing a fanzine. I was also helping the local radio station with their metal show and all these various things. And I was starting to promote some local shows. And there's this whole scene in LA of really good bands that nobody outside of LA knew even existed. And there was, you know, there were no labels back then that cared about what was going on in the metal world or anything. And I just was really influenced heavily by the new wave of British heavy metal that had happened, you know, in England right prior to all of this, and kind of the do-it-yourself attitude. And I thought, well, you know, all these bands are here and nobody knows they exist. Maybe if I can put out an album, maybe that'll help people realize that these bands exist here. So I just kind of went about doing it, really not anticipating having a label or anything, and just kind of doing it to help out the scene. And then put the record out, it did really well. Somebody offered me a distribution deal, and the next thing you know, a label forms, I guess.
And I read somewhere that you did the first 6 years solo. Is that true?
First 3 years were just me in my mom's garage all by myself.
What was that like once it became a label? Like, how was running the operation like back then?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started, it was hot. Because I was living in Woodland Hills, California, where it gets up to about 106 degrees in the summertime, and there was no air conditioning back then, so it was awfully warm. But, you know, I mean, look, it was a one-man band kind of thing, so it was exciting because I was learning all this different stuff, and I was literally doing everything from, you know, putting together the typesetting and the artwork and the lyrics and, you know, getting the vinyl pressed and making sure you got to the distributor and producing some of the records and, you know, all these things. So it was an incredible learning experience. And it was just I think back on it now, it's kind of nuts because I was working, you know, probably 18, 19 hours a day, every day, 7 days a week. But it was so much fun to be in that world back then when all these amazing new bands were coming up. So it was really kind of the right place at the right time, I think.
And what is your role like now with the label as CEO?
Well, you know, it's kind of sort of the same a little bit. You know, I oversee a lot of stuff. I still, you know, make sure, I still want to listen to everything that we're signing, and, you know, people give me bands and stuff all the time. I'm working with, you know, a lot of the bands at the label, just, you know, kind of making sure that everything goes the way we all hope it goes. So in a lot of ways, it hasn't particularly changed over the course of time. Certainly, I'm able to delegate a lot of the other stuff. Like, you know, I can't tell you how many albums were manufactured or something or any of those things. But, you know, I'm pretty well aware over it. And, you know, everybody in the label kind of runs everything by me just to make sure that it's all cool. So, you know, it's a lot of different, with an independent label, there's a million different hats. It's not like you're just kind of doing one specific thing. So it's a little bit of everything, which I think is one of the more fun things about doing it independently, is you can, you know, we can wake up in the morning and say, we want to do this today, as opposed to if it was a corporation or something, you have to say, we want to do this, but we have to have 15 people approve it. So,
but you're the person that needs to approve it now. It's pretty rad.
Exactly. So that's a nice freedom to have.
You said that you're still very much involved in signing bands. If you get handed a demo, what are things that make you just turn it off and decide maybe not?
Well, it's hard. You know, it's so hard to say. I mean, it's really kind of a dumb thing, but there's really not any specific thing. I mean, I'll just put something in or listen to something. I can usually, at this point in time, I can usually tell about 30 seconds whether it's something I want to listen to more of or be interested in. And there's no real formula. It's just something that hits me that I just say, oh, that sounds good. I really like that. And it doesn't really matter where the band's from or what they've done or if they have, you know, social media presence or any of those things that clearly you would like to have. And in this day and age, it's helpful if bands have all that because it makes it a lot easier. but it's just hard to say. Just something that I would listen to that I liked that I thought was interesting. And there's no real formula at all to it. That's kind of the same way it's been for the whole 35 years.
And without necessarily disparaging any of the acts, present or past, has the success of any artists you signed surprised you?
I think the success of a lot of stuff surprises me. Because I never really go into this with the attitude like, oh, this band's going to be huge. Because you just don't ever know. So, you know, going back to day one, you know, when Metallica was on the first label of Rat and then Slayer, and all these bands came along. I mean, never in a million years would I have ever expected any of them to be as big as they are. So I think I'm always surprised by any of that stuff. I mean, certainly, you know, you look at a band like Cannibal Corpse, for example, that we signed, you know, a million years ago on this, you know, crazy little demo tape, this really extreme band with all these extreme images. And, you know, now they're so huge, they're almost kind of mainstream even. That's kind of mind-boggling. You know, they're in Jim Carrey movies and things, you know. You never would expect that.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that today because they just announced a tour like hours ago. And they've always just been like a staple of Metal Blade. Were they one of those bands that you're like, I have to hold on to these guys with everything in my power?
Well, I think we try to do that with everybody. I mean, we try to, you know, we've been pretty lucky over the years. I mean, you know, obviously in the beginning we lost a ton of bands to the major labels just because we were a tiny little label and it made sense that happened. But most all of them eventually came back to us. So we like to keep bands as long as we can. And, you know, we have bands like Cannibal Corpse and Armored Saints and Amon Amarth and, you know, so many bands that have been with us for a very long time over their whole career, Lizzie Borden, I mean, you know, there's a lot of that stuff. So I think, you know, we like to think that we're kind of a family here and, you know, everybody's on the same page a lot of times and it's very friendly and familial-like. So and clearly we like keeping the bands here and, you know, sometimes you can do it and sometimes you can't, but we've been pretty lucky enough to be able to do that more often than not.
And I'm sure there's business sides of this or political sides of this, but are you still in touch with those folks from like the very early days? Like, I know Lars did the foreword of the book, but are you still in touch with the guys from Slayer or Rat these days?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know the Rat guys a little bit. I'm not as close to them as I am, but I mean, I'm still, all the Metallica guys I'm still really good friends with. Kerry King's actually one of my best friends. I see him all the time. We hang out constantly. And a lot of the, you know, same thing with a lot of the bands. So we've been really lucky with a lot of everybody we worked with from the early days, you know, still being good friends with, you know, pretty much all of them actually. So it's been nice to go along for the ride on that level too.
That's very cool. That was The Vengeance in Me from Serpentine Dominion from their self-titled record via Metal Blade Records. That band features Corpse Grinder from Cannibal Corpse as well as Adam D from Killswitch Engage. I'll have more with Brian Slagle in a moment, but first, this is my first band. Every musician has to start somewhere, and in this episode, Vicky from The Agonist discusses her heavy metal origins.
And I'll end with my favorite question to ask people, although I think I may know the answer already. What was your first band called, and what did it sound like?
My first band?
Or your first project or something?
I'm trying to think. It's been a while. I think the very first one I did was a live band, and it was like a jazz Latin cover band. Yeah, that was the one, and it was called Caribe Volcanica.
I know you said it's a jazz.
I don't think that was...
You said it's a jazz cover band. That's metal, though.
Yeah. What?
You said it's like a jazz cover band, but that sounds metal. Just a
name.
Oh,
really?
In name, yeah.
No, we were just a jazz Latin like cover band, you know, playing gigs for money. Definitely not anything like metal about it at all. It was like vocals and violin and keyboards, and not even drums. We had like some, what do you call those, percussion, like different percussion instruments, like a bongo, and I don't even remember. It was very different.
Could you listen to it now without cringing?
Yeah. I mean, I still like, just because I'm in the metal world, it doesn't mean that I just listen to metal.
Oh, of course.
You know? Like, yeah, like we mentioned Sting earlier, so, you know. But yeah, like we actually did play like Sting songs or others. Like I think we played Desert Rose because it has that like oriental vibe to it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I could listen to it.
You're one of the few who has answered that second follow-up positively, so.
Yeah, because usually, you know, your first band, especially if it's a metal band, you're like 15, let's say. Yeah. But I was like 20 at the time, or 21, so it wasn't that bad.
The Agonists are about to start a Canadian tour on August 4th. Hey, that's my birthday. For dates and all that good stuff, head to facebook.com/theagonistofficial or theagonistband.com. Before I wrap up my interview with Brian Slagle from Metal Blade Records, here's some of the live version of Between the Buried and Me's The Coma Machine from Coma Ecliptic Live. I don't expect you to remember this. I met you while I was very, very drunk on a roof in Austin like 4 years ago. It was part of South by Southwest. It was some night when Power Trip was playing, Junius, some other bands were playing also. And I was actually surprised to know who you were and see you on a roof. Do you make it out to many shows of younger bands or underground bands still?
I try to. It's a little harder these days to do just because a lot of times it's in places that I'm not necessarily at. But it's fun. I mean, some of the most fun ever is to, you know, go see a band play that, you know, is a brand new band playing in front of a few people, and then, you know, fast forward to 10 or 15 years later and they're, you know, pretty huge. So I try to do that as much as I can. It's difficult to do it nearly as much as I used to, just because we have so many different things on the label and so many places I need to be to do. But whenever I get a chance, it's fun to do. And I do remember that night. That was quite a fun evening there in Austin, as Austin generally can be.
This is going to be a little inside for my listeners, but I just met Munzee that night. And he pumped me full of beer, and that night's kind of a blur, but I was like, that's that dude from Metal Blade, and I just had to say something. So you were really cool, and you put up with my drunken stupidity, but yeah.
Oh, thanks, man. Well, I think we all had a couple of adult beverages that evening, so we're all in the same playing field, I think, more or less.
Do you still believe in the idea of a metal underground with how many outlets there are online now between like YouTube, Bandcamp, SoundCloud, and all that stuff?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think, you know, I mean, all of those places are certainly great and super helpful. I think the one issue we have now within the metal community, it's not just us, it's, you know, I think music in general, unless it's pop or hip-hop, there's so many different outlets and there's so many different places people go, it's really difficult to really get new bands a footing and to be heard. Because it's not like, you know, where you had, you know, way back in the day, Headbangers Ball or college radio, or then you had MySpace. You had all these different places where people could go and listen and find new artists. And it just doesn't exist now. There's so many different platforms. And they're all great and they're all super helpful. And we love working with all of them. But it does make it very difficult for a brand new band. Like, where do you start? It's impossible to be on all of them and have people go there. So it makes it very difficult to get something new happening. I think that's one of the reasons why it's been so tough to get, you know, new bands to really, you know, break through to that next level.
And Metal Blade has survived from everything: cassettes, CDs, streaming, music piracy, that thing Neil Young put out. What kept Metal Blade alive? Yeah, you know the triangle player I'm talking about? What was that? Is that still a thing? Yeah. Do you have one?
Yeah. No, I do not. I have a DAT player, though. I think it's just, I learned really, really early on, I talk about it a lot in the book, where, you know, I grew up with vinyl, and I was like, vinyl's never going to die. And then in, you know, about 1987, I did not listen to anybody that said, stop making vinyl and don't make nearly as vinyl. I'm like, no, it's not going to die. And we kept doing it, and it almost wiped out the company because we got all of it returned in one day, and we had this massive debt that we had to crawl out from under.
Brutal.
So I think, you know, going through that and kind of learning, okay, let's not do that again, it makes it a little bit easier for us to adapt to, you know, not only where the business is going, but also where scenes are going. We never really kind of, you know, got too involved in any specific scene, or, you know, a lot of labels start from a specific scene and then just stay in that scene. You know, we've always kind of been across the board and tried to sign a lot of different acts. So I think those two things, and being adaptable and embracing, you know, whatever it is, technology or whatever it is, I'd rather embrace that and see how we can use it to help us than not.
It's really cool. Metal Blade is like a label. I'm not just saying this to like kiss your ass. It's the logo was always something that was really important to me. The skull and like swords one, like seeing it on the Ocean albums or Three albums growing up, and even still with Allegiant or Native Construct. How did the logo, how did it come to be, and like what inspired it?
Oh, well, thanks. That's super nice. So one of the guys that works for us, so is our sales guy, our VP of sales and marketing, Dan Fitzgerald. He, you know, we were kind of looking at, like, you know, we kind of, you know, had a couple of different logos. We wanted to go in a different direction, kind of something new and fresh. And we really were just looking for something cool to put on a T-shirt at the time. And we weren't really looking to make it the logo that, you know, would be the face of the label. And he kind of came up with this logo and threw it out to our graphics guy, and he kind of, you know, adjusted a little bit and showed it to me. I was like, wow, that is awesome. So I think we started with a T-shirt, and the T-shirt did so well, and so many people loved the logo. We slowly, over about the next 6 months, started adding it to more things, and then we finally started putting it on all the physical product, and it kind of became the logo. So that was it.
So you guys aren't secretly like a band of pirates or something, and this is your way of showing it to the world that Tom Hanks movie is actually about you or something? What movie is
that? You never know.
Oh, there you go.
Cool.
Completely out of left field question. How did your relationship with Chris Santos come to be? Because I'm a big fan of Chopped, and when I finally put those two things together, it kind of blew my mind.
Oh, nice. It's funny. So Johan Hegg, the lead singer of Amon Amarth, is a very, very good friend of mine. And he was hanging at my house for... He was just in L.A. with his wife and hang out with me and my wife and I for about a week. And one hour, just kind of talking, he said, hey, you know this guy Chris Santos? He's on a TV show over here in America. I go, no. So we look up online, and like, oh, okay, he's on Chopped. And, you know, I've never watched the show, never really heard of him. He's like, oh, that's cool. You know, he's a cool guy. He had been out on Mayhem for about 2 weeks, just cooking for all the bands, and kind of was, you know, hanging out with Mastodon and Amon Amarth and all these guys who were on the Mayhem tour. And Johan and him became really good friends. So I was like, all right, cool. So I friended him on Twitter, and he immediately friended me back. And we kind of started talking through Twitter, and we met at a Slayer show. And we just started hanging out, and his taste and my taste were pretty similar. Super cool guy. I mean, I didn't know anything about Chopped, didn't know anything about the restaurant. I just knew, you know, he's a really cool guy. And a fun guy to hang out with, and our taste lined up pretty well. He was a fan of Metal Blade, so we just kind of became friends over that. And then eventually, about a year in, I was like, I should probably go to one of his restaurants, but I was a little nervous because he's a good guy. Like, what if I go and it's not going to be good? I got to tell him, like, oh, yeah, it was okay. So I went with a whole bunch of people just to be on the safe side. And it was one of the most amazing meals I've ever had. I was just completely blown away by how phenomenal it was. And then I started watching Chop, so I started seeing his TV side. But we just become really close friends over the last few years. And just really, Johan, like I said, Johan Haig was the one that introduced us, and then kind of went from there. But hang out all the time, and we talk all music. Very little, he doesn't like to talk about food. So I'm like, all right, I'll just eat your food, I won't talk about it.
And then that became Blacklight Media, which is rad.
Exactly. Yeah, well, that's kind of a funny story, too, because he had brought us four bands that we ended up signing. If These Trees Could Talk, Canberra, Mother Feather, and then Harm's Way. And I kept telling him, like, look, dude, if you want to be an A&R guy or have a label or do something, let me know. And he's like, nah, I don't want to do it. I got too much other stuff going on. And then finally, when I told him we signed the fourth band, he's like, oh, I don't want it now. Like, all right, well, let's do it then.
Changing gears a bit more, you've been in the business a long time, but I follow you on Instagram, and part of me still believes at heart you're like a nerdy metal guy. What keeps you excited? Like, because you've met a lot of people, you've seen potentially like the other sides of things, and you know, metal kids, there's like a hero complex certainly with looking up to bands as that sort of thing, but like, is there anybody that still keeps you like kind of makes you regress? Like, if you met your favorite musician growing up, would you nerd out a little bit?
You know, I mean, kind of, sort of. I'm still a huge fan, and I've been lucky enough through all these years to meet pretty much everybody, and 95, 98% of them have all been super cool. But there's definitely a few people, like, I've never met Tony Iommi, and I think if I did, I would be really nervous, because he kind of started this whole thing. I'm a little nervous because we're part of the Loudwire Awards, and I guess he's going to be there. But
you're finally going to meet him, then.
It's possible, but I'm good at avoiding that thing, because Iron Maiden is my all-time favorite band still to this day, and I've seen them, I don't know, probably close to 300 times. I'm friends with a couple of guys in the band. I'm friends with Rod Smallwood, which if you would have told me 18-year-old me that this would be the case, that'd be crazy. But I only met Steve Harris once when I interviewed him in 1981. So he's just one of those guys where, you know, I would just kind of clam up and not really know what to say. So I'm just going to stay away from that one.
Did you ever watch the show Community?
A little bit.
There's an episode where one of the characters, Troy, meets LeVar Burton, and he never wants to because he can't be disappointed by a picture. Is that what you're afraid of by meeting Tony Iommi?
No, I'm not afraid of that. Look, I would kill to have a picture with him. I'm just afraid, I know tons of people, all walks of life. I'm pretty comfortable with all of them. They're just people, you know. It's not like they're anything different. But a guy, just, for some reason, a guy like him would just be, I would just be, the only other person I'd probably do that with is Mario Lemieux. I'm a big hockey fan. I'm a big Mario Lemieux fan, and I've never met him. I don't think I would want to meet him because I'd just stand there like an idiot, just be like, you know. So easier to not meet them than you know, look like a moron, I guess.
That's fair. Were you ever in a band yourself?
No, I cannot play anything. I tried when I was a kid. Learn guitar or something, but I can play a halfway decent 4/4 beat on the drums, but that is it.
I usually end my interviews asking people what their first band was, but I'm like, I don't know if he's had a band.
No, never even remotely close enough to doing that.
Alrighty, sir. Well, the book drops at the end of August. I think the date I saw was 27th, correct?
29th.
Terrible journalist. So you've got 35 years. Are you guys already thinking about year 40?
Oh gosh, no. I'm just trying to get through the 35th. So let me get through that first, and then it'll be here before you know it. So we'll figure it out then.
All right. Well, thank you for talking to me. We'll talk around year 40, and you have a good rest of your day, sir.
Oh, thanks. You too, man. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Of course. Brian's book, For the Sake of Heaviness, The History of Metal Blade Records, will be released on August 29th via BMG Publishing. You can pre-order the book now from the Metal Blade store online at indiemerch.com/metalbladerecords. You can also pick up releases from Metal Blade artists past and present. Alrighty, like I said early in the show, I like to end every episode with a recommendation, and in this episode, I am recommending the band Drug Honky. They're an experimental doom band from Chicago that launched in 1997, and over the last 20 years, they've released 5 albums. Most recently, they released Cloak of Skies. From that album, here is Outlet of Hatred in its entirety.
Oh,
Colloquial Skies was released in May via Transcending Obscurity Records. For more on the band, head to facebook.com/drughonky and drughonky.bandcamp.com. That'll do it for this episode. As always, if you want to reach me, you can hit up facebook.com/farbeyondmetal. I'm on Twitter at Ovacord, or you can email me at farbeyondmetaldan@gmail.com. The theme music is Far Beyond Metal by Strapping Young Lad from their album The New Black, courtesy of Century Media Records and Devin Townsend himself. Thank you for listening.
A Catbox production.